really fantastic. We'll be using the hand raise feature of Zoom during the public comment portion of the meeting. So for folks who are dialed in on the phone, please note that *9 will allow you to raise your hand to be called on when you want to speak during the public mic section. Right now, everyone is automatically muted, so we will only be activating those microphones when we call on people to speak. Occasionally, if you have also muted yourself on your phone, you may have to unmute yourself as well, so we don't have people double muted. And we'll be getting started a little bit after, a couple minutes after 9, just to make sure that everybody has had time to log in. So thanks again for joining, and looking forward to the rest of this meeting.
So this is Jim Anderson. I have a question.
Yes.
The since Nikki placed the agenda in lieu of her, I no longer have visual connection with the rest of the commission. Just on a single screen of maybe who's talking.
Yeah. So you should, there should be a little bit of an option to make it more of a gallery view, and then there's the option to, there's like a little arrow that will allow you to cycle through. But yeah, I think as soon as we're done presenting materials, we'll want to go back, we'll stop sharing our screen just so that we can see each other's faces.
I'm fine. I understand that should be able to switch, but I'm not able to right now, so.
That would be kind of classy if you
All right, folks. Well, we have the 9 o'clock hour. So just wanted to do another introduction again for the folks that have just hopped on the line. We have, just making sure that we have everybody muted here so we don't have some background noise. We have a mix of folks joining the call today who are on their phone and on their computer. My name is Tess Wendell, and I'm from Ross Strategic, and my colleague Melissa and I are helping support the technical aspects of this meeting, particularly helping make sure that folks have a chance to participate during the public comment portion of the meeting. So if you're logged in via the phone, you can raise your hand to indicate that you want to say something during public comment by choosing *9 on your phone. That will raise your hand and we'll be able to call on you. For folks that have joined via the computer, there's a raise the hand icon down at the bottom of your screen. So everybody is currently muted who has joined the meeting, but when we get to the raise the hand part of the meeting, we'll be able to unmute folks and let people talk. So right now, we're going to start the meeting with an introduction from the Commission Chair, followed by a briefing from DFW staff. One thing to note is if you are on your phone, we will be calling on people using the last four digits of your phone number. So it could be helpful to quickly write down the last four digits of the phone number you are calling from. You'll notice that there's a question and answer option down at the bottom of the screen, and we're going to be using that primarily for technical issues, like not being able to connect via audio or see slides. So we will be monitoring that box, but we may not have the capacity to respond to every technical question or comment, but we will do our best. But note that the commissioners are not going to be seeing that coming through, so we are encouraging folks to use their voice for comment. You'll also notice if you're on the computer that the chat box functioned has been disabled for our public participants. That's not something that's broken on your computer. That's just something that we've turned off so that we can actually hear people speak in person. And I'm now going to turn it over to our chair, Larry Carpenter.
Good morning, all. Welcome to my colleagues on the commission, staff, and the public. April 9th, 2020. We have the Hatchery Reform Workshop webinar today. It's going to be a new experience for me and a few others as well. It'll be my pleasure in a moment to introduce Deputy Director Amy Winthrop, who's going to facilitate this meeting. I just wanted to say that I think I'm today in probably the prettiest place in the state, in beautiful Skagit Valley, and the sun's out up here. So anyway, are there any other commissioners that want to say anything or have any opening comments before we turn it over to Amy Winthrop? Hearing none, I guess, Amy, would you get us started, please?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Carpenter. So first, I just want to say hello for the director as well. Today, he's in the last day of the salmon season setting negotiations, and he sends his regards to all of you. The intent of reviewing the Commission's hatchery reform policy is to make things better for the conservation and recovery of wild fish and for sustainable fisheries. Combining the science review that we talked about the last time we met with this policy review, it allows us to evaluate as best we can, with all the caveats, whether the Commission's hatchery policy has made things better, yes, no, or unknown. At our last workshop, we explored emerging science and current science to understand whether implementation of the policy had made things better for the recovery of wild fish and sustainable fisheries. And at this workshop, we will explore how well the policy has been implemented. The commission is engaging in adaptive management, which is an essential element in all of our work as a conservation agency. To adaptively manage, and by that I mean to change our actions in response to relevant new information, we must monitor. And as we will discuss, monitoring is the single most significant obstacle to being able to answer the central question, did this work? We begin this adaptive management journey with the first monitoring question, did we implement the policy? And then we can ask, what was the effect of implementing it? And finally, the big question, did it work at a population scale? Today's workshop will begin with that first question, and then towards the end, we will look at some case studies to answer questions of effectiveness and population scale results. We'll be monitoring questions from each of the commissioners. I'll be watching for your hands, and I will interrupt the presenters as needed. I'll also try to keep us in timely fashion moving through the presentation. We do have a lot of slides, but at any time if the commissioners would like to ask a question, just use your little raise hand, and I will wait for sort of the right moment. Andrew and I are also chatting on the side, so I can send him notes of hurry up or slow down. So we're trying to do this as best we can. We will go through the first part of the presentation for an hour. We'll take some conversation after that. We'll have a break, and then we'll come back and do the last bit, and then we'll have public comment. Okay, so with that, I'd like to hand this presentation over to Andrew Murdoch and Gary Marston, who have been working on it, and with much appreciation to them for their work.
Thank you, Amy, Chair Carpenter and Commissioners. Thank you very much. Let me do an audio-visual check. Are we there?
You are good.
Visual's good. Audio's good.
Looks good from me.
Practice makes perfect. Thank you very much. Today I'm glad we're all here to participate in this workshop today, even if it's virtual. Let me go over the presentation outline. Like Amy said, we'll first talk about the report, and the report is really focused on the implementation of the policy guidelines. And we'll use a stoplight chart, and today during the presentation, we'll briefly go over the methodologies that we use to quantitatively assess some of these principles and the stoplight chart itself. And then we'll spend a few minutes, after we go through the stoplight chart and go through all 11 guidelines, we'll spend a few minutes talking about effectiveness monitoring in the natural environment. And this is important because for the rest of the workshop, you'll need to have that basic knowledge to kind of understand what we do when we actually go out and perform this kind of analysis in the natural environment. And we'll talk about those data, like Amy just suggested, the monitoring data that's so crucial to do that kind of work. And then we'll talk about lessons learned and recommendations. So during this process over the last, it's been over a year, I think now, there's been some lessons learned from staff about implementing the policy. We'll review some of those. And then we'll talk about the recommendations that are in the report that are really focused on recommendations to improve our ability to conduct hatchery effectiveness monitoring. Then we'll take a break, have questions about the report, and then we put together some Chinook salmon case studies of actually hatchery effectiveness monitoring. Three are quantitative and one is qualitative, and hopefully we can have enough time to go through all of those. And throughout this presentation, we did take the opportunity to address some of the questions that were raised in the December 13th guidance memo. So you'll see those kind of scattered throughout the presentation where they kind of fit within the talk. So let's first talk about the scope of the ask. Here's a map of the hatchery facilities throughout Washington State, and the numbers in each region are the number of programs. And right now we have 159 programs that we operate throughout the state. Most of those programs are, of course, in Western Washington. In Eastern Washington, where I live up here in Wenatchee, we have 22 programs that we monitor. I wanted to really quickly review some terminology that you saw during the science talk, because this terminology is used, we assume that everybody knows it, because this is a lot of our world now, and I just wanted to review for the commissioners some really basic information in terms that we use. PHAS, that's the proportion of naturally spawning fish that are of hatchery origin. And PNOB is the proportion of hatchery broodstock that are of natural origin. We use these terminologies quite a bit. And PNI is really the relative influence of natural selection. So you see the little formula, the way that we calculate it is PNOB over PNOB plus PHAS. And so for populations with a really low PNI, they are really driven by the hatchery fish. Populations with a really high PNOB, or excuse me, PNI, are predominantly of natural influence. So that's a real quick overview of some of the three key terms that we use kind of in this hatchery form setting. And as Amy pointed out, adaptive management is a process, an iterative process, not linear, in which a resource management action has been, you know, identified and then implemented. And that's kind of where we're at right now in this process. And then we collect data through time and analyze those data in order to learn what is working or what is not working. And then ultimately, we want to make adjustments to the project so that we understand what's working, what's not working, and then we repeat this process as often as necessary until we meet our management goals. And this is really important because in reality, this process is often not followed. Lack of funding to monitor, as we indicated in the report and what Amy mentioned, is usually the primary reason. But this process is important because a structured monitoring and evaluation program is the mechanism by which we are to achieve our hatchery goals. And in Part B of Guideline 1, I didn't make that up. That's in Part B of Guideline 1. So as Amy pointed out, the lack of MNME program across the state is really the reason why the effectiveness of our hatcheries and hatchery form actions could not be evaluated, and why really the report is really focusing on the implementation at this point in time. It's anticipated in the future we'll be able to do some broad-scale hatchery effectiveness monitoring. And the questions Amy talked about, so we're really focusing on the first two questions. What actions did we implement, and did those actions achieve expected outcomes? Typically, as you move through this process with this black arrow in the middle of the screen, these questions are increasing complexity and cost. And so with each question down below, I put kind of a product, if you will, or an example. So this report really gets at how we implemented the action and to the extent possible, and I'll admit we did not do this for every single guideline, compare the outcome to the expected or goal. And then finally, what we'll talk at the end of the workshop today is really, did management actions in the watershed result in a fish population response? And this is the holy grail of most folks involved in salmon recovery, whether it's hatcheries or habitat or even hydro and harvest. When you do a management action focused at conservation, what you really want to see is a response from the population. I think we've seen this slide before. This is how, of course, the report doesn't look like this one pager. It's a little longer than that, but we'll go through each of the 11 policy guidelines, and we'll talk about this in a stoplight chart format. Where we settled with the report card is four colors, not just three. And really, these are just quartiles, with red being the bottom 25%, with little to no progress towards full implementation. And then as we move up, 76 to 100% would be full or near full implementation of that guideline. And we'll go into a little bit more detail about that here. I did want to kind of provide an example in the report. There's a lot of tables that look kind of like this, and I wanted to go through a real simple example on how we kind of quantified the implementation of these principles or recommendations. And so this example was the use of local brood stock. And so the way we displayed this information is by region, and at the end is the total. So there's the 159 programs in each of those regions. We then went into the databases and we started looking at which programs use locally derived broodstock. So that's broodstock that's collected from the local river or from the local hatchery. And then we evaluated those based on these percentages at each region. And then for the report, we also pooled those data across regions for an overall assessment. And we did this because there's a lot of variability we found within the regions. And in the report, there's also an appendix for a regional report card if people are interested in looking at that spatial scale. So that's kind of it's not fancy math, stuff I can do all by myself. we're just going across regions and then pooling for the entire state. So for the purpose of this presentation, we tried to group the guidelines into four different categories. One, really, the hatchery reform guidelines, specifically some of those that were suspended. Then we'll talk about guidelines that are kind of more directed at the risks and benefits of hatcheries. And then finally, fishery reform benefits, and then reporting and funding. So the first guideline is very complex, and it's actually composed of three principles. And you can see the principles here. Develop clear, specific, quantifiable harvest and conservation goals within an all-age context. Design and operate hatchery programs in a scientific manner. And monitor and evaluate and adaptively manage the hatchery programs. Associated with each of these principles are specific recommendations. And for each principle, we'll briefly discuss each recommendation. And then the implementation of those recommendations was used to assess the overall principle. And then all three of these principles were then used to assess this overall guideline, kind of in a hierarchical manner. So principle one of guideline one comprised three specific recommendations. Express conservation goals to the population's biological significance, viability, recovery phase with triggers. And for most of our conservation programs, we did have goals, both abundance and productivity goals. There was some non-listed programs that did not have productivity goals, and there was a considerable number of programs that did not have triggers associated with the recovery phases. And we talk about that in the report. The second recommendation was express harvest goals in terms of specific fisheries. And as of right now, our hatchery programs are not managed at a hatchery program level, so there's no quantifiable goals for hatchery programs. So that was an easy one to assess. Unfortunately, we'll be working on that in the future. The third recommendation was really challenging. Ensure hatchery program goals are coordinated and compatible with other populations that might be affected. So when you dig into the literature and you try to understand what this recommendation is, this is really talking about at the program and population level, how are hatchery programs coordinated and compatible with each other in the natural environment? And will a specific hatchery program have any kind of impacts, negative or positive, on other populations or other programs within that watershed? And we struggled on how to evaluate this, in part because it really wasn't, there wasn't really a good spot to go collect some information or look at some data to understand if this has been done. And we tried unsuccessfully to develop surrogate metrics that would kind of get at this. But at the end of the day, we really just had to punt on this recommendation because we could not really truly evaluate the intent of the recommendation as written. I think it's going to take some more thought and discussion about how we would do this in the future. So for principle one, we rated overall orange. So for the presentation, I put this little O in the middle in case people can't tell the difference between yellow and orange. For the second principle, design and operate hatchery programs in a scientific defensible manner. There was quite a few recommendations under this principle. And many of these recommendations, we developed metrics directly from the recommendations, or we had developed surrogate metrics, which are listed in the parentheses at each of these on the table. So for example, recommendation 4 and 5, we were able to assess these recommendations directly. So we were able to look right into the database, understand the purpose of each program 100% of the time. The explicitly state assumptions relative to program goals. So as part of our work in developing these programs, there were a series of models used, and I'm sorry I didn't have the, so AHA is the All-H Analyzer. It's a model that we use to evaluate hatchery program scenarios. PCD Risk is a predation competition and disease risk model developed by the department to evaluate ecological interactions. And then there was a gene flow model developed for West Side Steelhead programs that was used. So we can go into each of those models and look at the assumptions that were stated in those models. So that was those were pretty relatively straightforward recommendations that we could address. But for example, recommendation 7, looking at the size of the program relative to the goals, we didn't really have a good way of trying to understand how to evaluate that program or evaluate that recommendation. So we used state stray rates, in part because our harvest programs don't have goals. So it's hard to understand a recommendation based on goals when the program doesn't have a goal. So we use stray rates as a surrogate. That's not to say that we hit that recommendation, but using that surrogate, 66% of the programs met that recommendation. Or recommendation 13 was another one, maximizing the survival of hatchery fish. So a lot of the programs don't have program-specific survival goals. So we used SARs as a surrogate metric, SARs being survival to adult return. So this is the ratio of the number of adult return, number of adult fish that return from a group of juveniles that were released at some point in the past. And most of the, so we assumed, and so for many of the programs, we didn't have a really good complete set of SAR data. So there are some programs where we really don't even know the survival of the hatchery fish we release. But for the Chinook programs was the most complete data set. So we then relied on the Chinook programs as a surrogate for best hatchery practices for the other programs that a hatchery may release. And so when we started looking at Chinook SARs, we found that when compared to other non-DFW programs and other DFW programs across the region, that our hatcheries, one, seem to have relatively similar or better survival across the state. And more importantly, across time, the variability in that survival was relatively low. So that how these hatcheries are being operated relative to SARs, they seem to be operated consistently through time, which I think is a good indication of at least consistent hatchery practices within the state.
Hey, Andrew.
Yes.
Let's just take a moment to pause here because that was a really nice summary of a lot of information. Let's just give the commissioners a minute to see if we have any hands pop up. So let's just pause for a moment here.
And I think in the report, we tried to go through each of these recommendations in detail. And so you can have any additional questions, we can refer to the report. I'll be happy to try to answer them on the spot.
Okay, I don't see any hands going up. So go ahead and keep on.
Okay, so we're almost done with guideline one. Then there's 10 more. And the third principle for guideline one is monitor and evaluate and adaptively manage these hatchery programs. And we put three recommendations under this one. The first one, really looking at these relative reproductive success studies. One of the recommendations was prioritize research on factors affecting relative reproductive success. And so within the agency, we have several relative reproductive success studies ongoing. They're really focused on spring Chinook and steelhead, which in the Columbia Basin are the primary listed fish. This recommendation got 75% because the number one hatchery program within the state, which is a fall Chinook sub-yearling program, is not adequately represented in the literature. And so what you'll see is one of the recommendations is we really need to, so sub-yearling Chinook also spend the least amount of time within the hatchery. But a multi-generational fall Chinook relative reproductive success study would be a great addition to the literature and our understanding about the effects of those types of programs on fitness in the natural environment. And sub-yearling fall Chinook represent about 70% of our releases overall. So it is a really big missing component. The third recommendation 16 really talks about just adaptively managing hatchery programs. And so for this, we went to look for M&E programs. And we found that most of our programs do not have M&E programs, but some of them do. And those programs are typically regional, species-specific, or program-specific. So we did not try to compare M&E programs across the state. We just looked for the presence of an M&E program in, use that as the metric. And as Amy pointed out, this is really one of the primary issues that we'll talk about in the recommendations. And finally, discontinue or modify risks of the program if they outweigh the benefits. And so, again, this was a really kind of a tough one to evaluate because there's been a long history of modifying or starting and stopping programs. So what we did is we looked across the regions, across every region, and we looked for consistency in how programs were operated. And in all regions, we found multiple cases where programs were modified or discontinued for reasons we assume were relative to risk outweighing benefits.
Hey, Andrew.
Yeah.
You're coming in and out a little bit in your audio. I don't know if that's because you're moving around, but do the thing that makes you louder.
Okay, I can try to turn up my volume.
Also, this is Dave Grayville. Question on M&E programs. What is that?
Oh, okay. Sorry. M&E programs is monitoring and evaluation programs. So these would be a structured program that's implemented it can look like a lot of different things. Am I sounding better now? I turned up my volume.
Yeah, you do.
Okay. So an M&E program is what we use to define what kind of information we need to collect in order to evaluate the, I don't want to get too technical, in order to evaluate the monitoring objectives of the hatchery program. So, and these things are usually well-defined in protocols that can be applied across the state or across programs. And it's the mechanism in which we evaluate, it's the mechanism where you actually list your targets for different kind of activities or your goals for your programs or the survival goals for your hatchery fish. And it's there's quite a few examples. In the Upper Columbia, we have, working with the Upper Columbia PUDs, we have some pretty comprehensive M&E programs. They get into in-hatchery monitoring, natural production monitoring, and then finally the analytical design on how we would analyze all these informations. So they can be very basic or they can be more comprehensive. Does that help you, Commissioner Graybell?
Yes, thank you.
So Commissioner Thorburn has a question, and then we'll go with Commissioner McIsaac.
So I'm wondering if our HGMPs require M&E programs, or is that sort of hatchery by hatchery and plan by plan?
So, you know what? I will let my co-author, Gary Marston, talk to you about. He is more familiar with HGMPs than I am. Gary?
Yes. So, Commissioner Thorburn, the HGMPs do have a monitoring and evaluation piece in them, but it's not to the extent that we would look for like a monitoring evaluation plan. It's relatively basic. The HGMPs really are just a permit for our hatchery programs under the Endangered Species Act. So they ask for some very basic information around monitoring and evaluation, but not to the level of detail we would really want for a M&E plan.
Commissioner McIsaac?
Okay, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I actually have a question on the previous slide. I think it was the previous slide. Yes, on number 7. Size the program based on goals under an all-age strategy. So you mentioned that there isn't really a goal for harvest, and it made evaluating this a little bit difficult, and so the stray rates was used. This question kind of gets into a mitigation hatchery concept. So if you have a mitigation hatchery that's supposed to replace 30,000 fish due to the building of a dam or something like that, and you're wondering whether the program is sized properly considering harvest, hatcheries, hydro, and habitat, and you consider all of those things, it would seem that at the end, you add up catch and escapement, you look at the habitat situation, and you look at the hydro situation, and either add or subtract fish and ask yourself, is the run being replaced to 30,000 as was originally intended? If you use stray rates, it seems like you're wondering whether the program is too big or not based on strays going to adjacent streams. And so the question is, the stray rate really give you an answer to your question of your program, if your program achieves the mitigation goal, and what is the stray rate that comes up with a metric of 66%? Does that mean there's too many strays or the strays are okay? What are your thresholds for getting back to an answer of, well, is the program too small, too big, or just right?
So let me try to answer those questions. Stray rate is not the perfect metric for this recommendation. In the scenario in which you described, we might look at, depending on the goals, right, and these goals would be within this monitoring and evaluation program, a mitigation program which we have in the Upper Columbia, all of our programs up here are mitigation. We wrestle with this all the time. So if, let me get to the first question. So if we did have goals for every program, then we'd be able to evaluate those goals based on using other criteria, either the return goal for that program, like you said, does it replace the production that was lost as a result of the mitigation? Or we could use what we call a hatchery replacement rate. So are we getting, for the number of fish that we release, are we getting the expected number of returns? And that can be a co-manager agreed to value. So there's a lot, so depending on the different hatchery program, there's lots of ways that we can address this recommendation. But when we're looking across the entire state, in the absence of a lot of those goals that would make this job easier, or maybe not easier, but it would make the job more, it would make the assessment more transparent. We can then relate a goal to an observed outcome. We can't do that because we lack a lot of the goals. So instead, what we tried to do, without punting on a lot of these recommendations, what we tried to then do, our logic was, is that if a program as operated has a stray rate greater, an average stray rate greater than 5%, and 5% is usually the threshold for stray rates in between independent populations. And so what we did is, again, these are surrogate metrics, not perfect metrics. So we then looked at the information that was available. We looked at what proportion of those programs had stray rates higher than 5%. Now, that stray rate could simply be due to nothing about the size of the program. It could be really an acclimation problem for that specific program, that they simply just need more acclimation to increase homing to their natal stream. But as in many of these recommendations, we were kind of left with a one-size-fits-all approach. And I agree, sometimes, and you'll see in future slides, one size doesn't fit all for this stuff. Every hatchery program is different. Every population is different.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. That's a difficult question for sure.
Yeah, well, and these are those ones that were, it was really, we spent most of our time trying to figure out what metric we're going to use. And then once we did it, it was a little bit more simple. But it was a challenge.
Commissioner Anderson?
Or whatever the case is, but my question is regarding the HGMPs. If there is no Endangered Species Act listing, say in the Willapo or perhaps with a particular species elsewhere, then is it fair to assume that there's no HGMP for that facility?
Hi, Commissioner Anderson. Yeah, so for all of our coastal programs, we do not have HGMPs in place. There's no listed species, so we're not required to have HGMPs. And I think one of the next slides will indicate how many HGMPs or hatchery plans we have in place. And that's where that one we really get dinged on, because we just are not required to have HGMPs on the coast due to lack of listed species out there. Does that answer your question?
Yes. I've got some follow-ups I'll get to later, I think. Okay.
Okay. Anything else on this last third principle of guideline one? Or can we move on?
Yeah, keep going.
All right. So related to that, this is one of these next few slides really address some of the questions raised in the December 13 guide memo. And specifically, where has the policy been the reason for hatchery reductions? And here's a slide that Gary put together about overall releases of Chinook and Coho and Puget Sound over the last multiple decades. And clearly, in the 90s, there was a pretty big decline in hatchery releases overall. And then for the last 15 or 20 years or so, there's been a little bit of variability, but it stayed relatively constant around 60 million. But this is for all releases. So what we really wanted to try to pinpoint and to address specifically this comment was releases related to the program or to the policy. And so we look to Western Washington Chinook, and the reason why is because Columbia River Chinook, really, we don't have general fund state programs necessarily operating in the Columbia Basin. All those programs are funded through different mechanisms and are subject to a multiple of other agreements, including ESA, but USV Oregon and the Mitigation and Mitchell Act agreements. So for the Columbia River overall, for all the hatchery programs, they really fall outside, in many cases, this policy, because they're governed by a whole bunch of different processes and committees and co-management that DFW just cannot do unilaterally. So we focused this question on Western Washington Chinook, both in Puget Sound and on the coast. And we picked a few different years, and we did see a decline from 07 to 11. And then there was another uptick between 11 and 17. And what we saw was a 7% decline across these 10 years. So then we tried to get at the reason why the decline happened. And that was a little bit more challenging. But when we start looking for the decreases on the left and increases on the right, and we start trying to figure out the reason for the increase or decrease, what we came up with in many cases was the hatchery reform policy in decreases were responsible for three, and then in turns, they're also responsible for two increases somewhere else. So the net loss right now, today, attributed to the hatchery reform policy is about 100,000 Chinook. More obvious is the 1.6 million due to Wolf Bay policy, which I'll admit I am not completely familiar with. But other important factors was funding. So some of that big drop was due to the financial crisis. And then when the financial crisis was over, funding was restored and a lot of those programs came back. And then there was a couple of minor other issues with performance. And I don't know what the other one was. So at the end of the day, what we've seen really attributed to the policy is a very minor in Western Washington, really a minor decrease in overall production directly attributed to that policy. So guideline two, improve broodstock management to reduce ecological and genetic impacts and hit those standards by 2015.
Hey, Andrew, you're coming in and out again.
Oh, okay. I'm really just sitting.
Come close.
I'm sitting here. So there are two primary ways in which to achieve this HSRG standard. Reduce PHAS or increase PNOB. So reduce the proportion of hatchery fish on the spawning grounds or increase the proportion of broodstock, natural origin broodstock. So as adult returns from mass marking were fully implemented, our estimates of PHAS in some streams were higher than previously estimated, but they were now more accurate. So for example, 15 years ago, many of the fish that we released were not adipose fin clipped. And so for sub-yearling fall Chinook, which is 70% of our releases, when those fish come back, there is it's very difficult to determine hatchery and wild origin without an external mark or an internal tag. Conversely, steelhead and spring Chinook, which are released as yearlings, we can use scale pattern analysis to assign origin. But for the sub-yearling fish, the scale patterns of hatchery and wild fish look very similar. And so without mass marking, it was extremely difficult to assign hatchery and natural origin without having a mark visible on that fish or a tag in that snout. And so early estimates of PHAS, which were reported to the committee, were kind of these estimated PHAS estimates derived through modeling of number of fish releases and expected SARs. But as those mass marked fish came back, that uncertainty decreased. And so now all of a sudden, our estimates have changed, and some of those estimates went higher. And then once we started getting more accurate estimates of PHAS, well, then the ocean started to fall out. And so now our ability to increase the natural origin abundance in the broodstock, which is the alternate way of hitting these goals, was curtailed by poor ocean conditions. So we kind of got this consecutive effect of higher PHAS and then lower ability to meet PNOB goals, which really shifted some of our programs from a meet the standards to a not meet standard. We're still doing pretty good, 73%, But that is a lower number than I think the commission was has been seen before. And as we move forward, these numbers will kind of go up and down, but hopefully, as things improve, these numbers steadily increase.
Andrew, this is Gary. I just wanted to add, so particularly Coho were hit quite hard by the blob conditions we had 2015 and continuing on from that. So we saw, particularly for our coastal Coho programs, some programs that had been meeting rootstock standards no longer were meeting those standards. And Andrew also mentioned the importance of mass marking. One of the other challenges is for pink salmon and chum salmon programs, we are, due to the size of the fish released, we're still not able to mass mark those fish with an externally visible mark. You know, they often have otoliths marks, which require otoliths to be taken and then assessed in the lab, but that provides another really large challenge for those programs.
Okay, moving on.
Turn back over.
Question?
Hey, Andrew, just so you know, you're halfway mark in terms of time.
Okay. Well, these are some of the most important ones. The other ones will go a lot faster. So the third one, guideline three, was the last of the suspended guidelines, and this was develop watershed action plans in an all-age approach. So this guideline actually was one of the most challenging to assess, and possibly one of the most important in terms of meeting hatchery program goals. There is no official watershed action plans agreed to by co-managers. So one could argue that this recommendation was not implemented at all. But in the absence of action plans, which are really, there's a lot of reasons why those action plans didn't come to light out of the department's control. So in the absence of those action plans, we developed surrogate metrics, and as Gary pointed out, we use the all-age analyzer models and the HGMPs as a way of, so within, from an all-age perspective, these are the surrogate metrics that we used to evaluate this objective. And those metrics are not an action plan or even close, but it was actions that the agency took to try to address the intent of this guideline. Every program that we operate was assessed using the all-age analyzer model. And most of the programs, as Gary pointed out, do have an HGMP associated as they deal with listed fish. While these processes don't equate to an action plan, they do represent how we kind of justify the program.
Andrew, for those ones that don't have HGMPs, in some cases we do have monitoring plans that, you know, kind of do act as the surrogate. So, you know, in those cases, we do have those ones getting a pass here.
And, okay. Thank you.
That's mentioned.
So, I mean, fully agreed to and funded watershed action plans would be a great goal. But I think it really represents a paradigm shift in how we currently manage hatcheries, harvest, and habitat. Everybody is going to have to come together in order to make that happen. So those were the most difficult ones, the most ones that we had problems with. The rest of these guidelines were much more direct, and I think we can go through these relatively quickly. And they really involve hatchery benefits and risk. The first one really related to the compliance of our hatchery facilities, and we found we've been making great progress, been getting a lot of things funded through general fund and other mechanisms. We have a few hatcheries with some outstanding water quantity issues that we're dealing with, but overall we're in good shape. Externally marked all hatchery coho and steelhead. We're doing really good, except for one program. Priest Rapids Hatchery, Fall Chinook, we have over 3 million fish that are not routinely marked every year. The size of this program is so large that it really draws down the whole average. But everybody else, we're right on. The little bit of fish that are not marked are designed not to be marked either for conservation purposes or for research purposes. This is really the only one program that we can find where there is a large component of fish that could be marked to improve both M&E and meeting hatchery goals.
Hey, Andrew.
Yeah.
Commissioner McIsaac has a question.
Sure.
Yes, thank you. Why are the Priest Rapids Hatchery Fall Chinook 3 million not marked?
That is a issue that actually predates me. I think it's a issue between co-managers and the PUD. And I could guess, but we should probably have that discussion later. But it's an ongoing identified issue. Wild salmonid management zones. So throughout the state, we assessed that we had a total of 54 MPGs. The recommendation is to have one wild salmonid management zone per species per MPG. So that number is 54. Right now, we have 7 steelhead and 1 fall chinook officially. So there's a lot of room for improvement on this one. There is considerable number of recommended wild salmonid management zones, but right now we have 8 official. There was another question regarding wild salmonid management zones. So what we did to try to address that is we looked at the Wind River, which is one of our populations, and the Hood River, which is just across the river and up a little bit. Now, we picked these two streams, these two populations, because, one, they experience similar Alid Basin effects. So they're immediately upstream of Bonneville Dam. They also have similar in-basin effects in terms of a dam. So there was a dam removed in 09 and in 010 in each of these systems, which opened up more habitat and provided better passage upstream and downstream. And both of these populations also have high-quality abundance time series. The big difference being is that in the Wind River, the average PHAS is less than 1% or less than 0.01. And in the Hood River, it's variable, but at an average of 0.46. So when we just, this is a qualitative look. So when we just throw these numbers up on the graph, we see a pretty big difference in the trends of these populations. Since 1990, the Wind River has been slowly increasing. And the Hood River has been slowly decreasing. Correlation is not causation. I am not saying that hatchery fish caused the decline in summer Chinook. I think there's a lot of other papers that kind of point to that. Nor am I saying the lack of hatchery fish in the Wind River is the cause of the increase of wild fish. This is just a qualitative comparison to kind of give you a feel for what's going on out there. The risk from hatchery fish in the Wind River is near zero. I think there's just a few strays that go in there. The Hood River was a population that was intensively studied and reported on, and we know that the hatchery summer steelhead in that population had a really low relative reproductive success. And ODF&W are now no longer releasing hatchery summer chinook in that population. This is the one example that we can find. There are few because we don't really have similar time series to make this kind of comparison. I did also want to point out that the East Fork of the Lewis River is another wild salmonid zone, and staff actually did an analysis of fishing effort up there and saw no significant difference as a result of that change in management. What we're seeing is just a different fishery. The catch and release wild fishery is still popular as it was when there was hatchery fish up there. Moving quickly, fishery reform guidelines. We were supposed to use alternative gear, both develop, promote, and implement. Overall, this recommendation got a yellow. The gear were developed and assessed by department staff, but indirect mortality was still relatively high. the gear was promoted both in the Lower Columbia and the coast, and you can see some harvest graph down below. Primarily, the Lower Columbia Spring Chinook has been the most reliable alternative gear season that we've had. We also had some fall Chinook as of lately and some coho. Implementation was really limited in part because the collapse of the ocean conditions caused a lower abundance of hatchery fish relative to wild fish, and the overall cost for implementing this gear was too great given the expected revenue. The other guideline
Hey, Andrew?
Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, we got it. We got a question from Commissioner Baker.
Yeah. Sorry, you're on mute.
I'd unmute. On the alternative gear slide, was that segmented in any way due to the gear? So are we talking tangle nets or those pound nets, or do we know?
So we don't have any pound net data in here. This is all tangle nets, I think. And there was some seining. I think there was a small bit of seining. I think we've broken that out in the report.
Okay, thank you.
The pound net stuff is not in here. That's still, I think that's still kind of under development officially. Mark, select the fisheries. The guideline was define full implementation and develop a plan to fully implement Mark Selective Fisheries across the state. Technically, we did not officially define the plan or have defined what full implementation was or develop a plan. But what we did do is we really drastically increased the number of Mark Selective Fisheries. And those numbers peaked in 2016, and then once the ocean fell apart, we started seeing a steady decline. We have both an increase in commercial and sport being the dominant. And this was, although technically we didn't define it, I think the intent of this guideline was fully realized. For example, we had a fishery in 2016. We had the first summer Chinook fishery in the Wenatchee River in almost 30 years, and it was because of these efforts. Another question posed in the guidance memo was, how did this policy affect fisheries? And so what I've been told is that fisheries really have not been directly affected by this policy positively or negatively. For the most of the big mixed stock fisheries, they aren't impacted by a change in a single program release goals. So we use all the hatcheries within a given area to support a fishery, and it's usually managed on an exploitation rate approach. And secondly, overall changes in abundance associated with the ocean conditions and specific fisheries could be impacted by ESA impacts are usually the driver between fishery and openers and closures. So we couldn't really point to any specific issue from a fishery standpoint associated with this policy.
Hey, Andrew.
Yeah.
We have Commissioner Anderson has a question.
Sure.
Obvious to everyone else, but with regard to the Mark Selective Fishery pie graph and the captions of 33, and 15, what am I missing? What's that stand for?
Oh, these are the 33 is the number of Mark Selective Fisheries that were sport, and 15 is the number of commercial Mark Selective Fisheries.
Okay, so it's just simply a number and a
Yeah, okay. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, yeah. N equals 33, which represents 69% of the Mark Selective Fisheries.
Commissioner okay. McIsaac has a question.
Yes, thank you. On the slide that you had just finished, fisheries have not been directly affected by this policy, and you mentioned mixed stock fisheries. So we hear from the folks down in Willapa that the change of big reduction at Forks Creek Hatchery is making a big difference in fisheries. Now, I don't know if that's called a mixed stock fishery or not. Generally, mixed stock fisheries are not impacted by a change in a single program release schools. When you have many changes, such as we've seen for coho on the Columbia River, there are mixed stock fisheries out in the ocean that are, some people argue, are seeing quite a change because of that. So you want to respond to any of that? Seems like that's what we're hearing anyway.
Yeah, you know, I am probably not, I can guarantee you I am not the best person to address fisheries. I'm a hatchery guy. And I don't know if I can punt to somebody on the phone, or maybe we can follow up with you later.
Later is just fine, yeah.
Phone a friend is not an option, I guess. We got time constraints. But I hear you. All right, so hatchery reform guidelines. These are reporting and funding. Guideline number 6 was a no-brainer. The 2020 benchmarks called out are really redundant in the other guidelines. So instead of kind of like giving us credit twice, we just decided not to even assess it. Because they're really, the guidelines in the 21st century salmon steelhead were the same things that we were already evaluating in these other guidelines. So they were just simply redundant. Guideline 7 was really a reporting to you guys, to the Fish and Wildlife Commission. And as we went back through time, we found the last comprehensive report was really done in 2012. And since then, there's been kind of a maybe a more emphasis on broodstock management throughout the years. Some years there wasn't any kind of update, but in most years there was. And guideline 9 was really about seeking funding to implement reform. And so since our data went back to 07, we've been able to get $64 million in funding, which is a lot of money for sure, or you can say $5.3 million annually, or you can look at $1.5 million per facility, or $124,000 per facility per year. So it's a lot of money, but we also have a lot of hatchery facilities and a lot of programs to deal with. From a fishery reform aspect, we did almost as good. We got $33 million, $13 million of which came from the Columbia River salmon endorsement standpoint. So while we weren't able to get all, we got a yellow. We made really good progress. And so that concludes the report card for the 11 guidelines.
All
and
right.
I'll pause for any questions, and then I got a few more things, and then we can open it up.
Okay, you're doing great, Andrew.
Okay.
Take a breath, and let's see if anybody's hand comes up. I got an answer back. I did phone a friend for answering the question about Priest Rapids, and then I got a text back. It's fairly brief, but we can follow up more as well, Commissioner McIsaac. But essentially, marking at Priest Rapids is an ongoing issue that the USV Oregon parties are working through at a policy level. Okay, so this is sort of a transition point in our presentation where we've gone through the red light, green light section of it. And now we're going to talk a little bit about the effectiveness monitoring piece. And so I don't see any hands coming up. And so let's keep going, Andrew, and we'll see what we get next, okay?
Okay, yeah. So I wanted to spend just a little bit of time talking about monitoring in the natural environment. Here's just a conceptual graph that I made up. The point is that, you know, when we start looking at designing these kind of programs, we should spend a little bit of time designing them, of course, but most of their time is actually going out in the field, monitoring and collecting data. And then once that's done, we spend a considerable amount of time analyzing those data. And I really wanted to talk about the analysis piece because it really has it's important that everybody kind of has a basic understanding for the rest of the presentation. And so what we're really talking about now is looking at trying to address this third question and trying to look at population level responses, which is a challenge. But before we do that, hatchery reform is really designed to minimize potential adverse impacts to hatcheries and natural populations while improving sustainable fisheries. That being said, M&E programs in general are designed to evaluate the effectiveness of an entire program. So any specific action, like is a PHAS level of 0.03 better or worse than a PHAS level of 0.6? Those types of analyses are really going to be very data intense because the programs are really designed to look at an overall goal for the entire program and the cumulative benefits and risk associated with that program. Alternatively, if we wanted to look and test specific hypotheses, then we should start setting up more population-level experiments in order to kind of get at that level of detail. So I'm not talking about that level of detail. In the natural monitoring piece, what we're really talking about is trying to detect an effect of a hatchery program, period. So detecting change in the natural environment or a specific management action is really challenging. And we really need a study design where the treatment effect, which is the hatchery fish, is not confounded. And so when we look to the literature, I think Joe and his staff gave you a few examples. There's really a few when we talk about hatchery effectiveness. There's the three that I'm going to be talking. So there's the general approach, which is called this before after control impact, and I'm going to be specifically talking about that study design because it is kind of the standard for conducting natural resource action effectiveness, whether it's hatcheries or timber harvest management or whatever. That kind of before-after control impact is kind of the standard. And there are three published studies that look at hatchery effectiveness. There are more, sophisticated statistical models that people have used. Mark Sherrell and Eric Buell did a couple of papers. And I'm not even going to try to attempt to explain those. We're going to focus on this before-after control impact, which is the approach we used in the Columbia Basin. And so just to kind of get everybody orientated, I'm just going to walk you through the kind of data associated with this stuff, and it's pretty straightforward. What we want to do is identify a control and treatment population. So this treatment population would be a population in which we're going to start a hatchery program, for example. And here's two time series, data series, that look at natural fish abundance. And what we see is that through time, these two populations are really highly correlated. And that's a key to this study design. We use the control population to control for the natural variability in productivity so that the only difference between these two populations in the future will be the treatment effect or the hatchery program. So it's really important that you get two populations that track each other really well. And so the average difference between this, and this is called the before period. So the average difference between these two populations is 222, for example. Then we implement some kind of action. And we know from our past experience, sometimes it takes a few years to implement an action. But for the sake of this study, we're going to say, yep, we implemented the action in 1 year. And then from that point in time forward is the after period. All right. So again, we use the same methodologies, we collect the same data, and we look at natural fish abundance. And what we observed in these two hypothetical populations is that the control population, for some natural reason, decreased a little bit, and the treatment population with the hatchery program increased a little bit. So now the difference between these two populations is 370 fish. So we had a positive difference of 148 fish. And that is essentially a real basic before-after control impact. Now, there's some statistics we do to look at statistical significance. But really, what you're doing is comparing the differences before to the differences after. And I really like to put, and these differences are significant, statistically significant. But I like to put some trend lines so it's easier for people to see how these two populations really track each other before a management action and then after a management action. So it's important just to understand that's the approach that we typically use to do this type of work, depending on whatever, regardless of what management action it is, and that fish natural fish, or actually usually spawner abundance, both hatchery and wild spawner abundance, are really the key metrics for this kind of approach. There's other metrics that you can use with this approach. For example, we use productivity, and we can look at changes in recruits per spawner. But it's all derived essentially from this, the same time series of data, which is spawner abundance. And here's an example. I did an analysis in 2010 for conservation programs up in the Methow funded by Douglas County PUD. And so I had several control streams. This one is Valley Creek up in the upper Snake River. And you can see in the before period that these two populations, one in the upper Columbia, one in the upper Snake, track each other very well. So their out-of-basin effects are very similar. They kind of go through the same number of dams. And then in the after period, so this program started in 1992. The first adult returns were in 1994. And what we saw, at least in this one example, is we saw actually a similar trend in the after period. So we really couldn't, so there was no significant difference, positive or negatively, between these two. So this is just a theoretical example and a real-world example. So put a pin on that, and let's talk about lessons learned. Lessons learned from actually doing this report and trying to conduct this analysis. We found that implementing reform actions is complicated and it takes time. The variability implementation is across the state is large. Funding, co-management, FERC, Mitchell Acts, there's a wide variety of things that really affect how and when you can actually implement reform actions. And the effectiveness of those implementation actions is also uncertain. So I got information from a colleague, Thomas Burns, who is running the WEIR program down in south western Washington. And so, and they were supposed to control PHAS. Throughout, his analysis showed that only 5% of the time were they able to hit goals. So they implemented this action across many multiple streams, but only 5% of the time did they actually hit their goal. So it's not just implementing the project, it's actually understanding the effectiveness of that implementation. And that applies to habitat restoration as well. Just because you do a project doesn't mean it worked. And it goes back to that second question in that graph that Amy and I showed you. Secondly, we really need to have a proper study design. If we have a good study design, then the data's there. With this Bakke approach, like I said, in the upper Columbia, we use these upper Snake programs. There's a lot of nice wild populations in the upper Snake that we can draw from. Those may not be appropriate for the rest of the state. Coastal populations may need to use coastal Oregon, for example. Puget Sound maybe looked at western BC for populations. And we have to look outside the state because, like we saw earlier, we don't have a lot of populations that don't have hatchery fish in them. And like we talked about before, when we do this, there's really, I shouldn't say there's no before period, but there's a very, maybe there is no before period because of lack of, I guess there's a lot of uncertainty in the before period because of this lack of mass marking. We may have better data for other species like steelhead and coho where we can use scale analysis, but for a lot of the fall Chinook programs, the before period is potentially an issue due to the lack of mass marking. In the upper Columbia where I work, hatchery programs were 100% marked from day one, and so we don't really have that issue up here. But we still have a lot of uncertainty. It's improving in PHAS, but there's still a lot of uncertainty. And really, statistically, the after period, I think, is probably too short. So the detectable effect size, right, our ability to detect a difference between the before period and after period, that effect size decreases with time. So if we wanted to do the analysis in 5 years, we would probably only be able to detect a very huge difference, right? But through time, the years are our power, right? We get statistical power from each observation year. And so as time progresses in both the before period and the after period, for that matter, our ability to detect a smaller difference improves. And so, again, 15 to 30 years, if we can do the analysis and kind of actually do a power analysis and show you what kind of effect size we can detect through time. But we do need a considerable period of time to look at doing the analysis. Additionally, the precision of spawner abundance estimates will also reduce the time period. So if we have really tight correlations like I showed you in my theoretical example, that's going to greatly improve our ability to make inferences on how the program is working. If there's a lot of uncertainty in spawner escapement estimates, then that also just adds a lot more process error or noise to the analysis. So getting good, like you'll see in the next section, the recommendations, getting really good precise spawner abundance estimates is critical for a whole bunch of reasons. So now I'm going to go into the eight recommendations that are in the report. I've tried to, you'll see a green one up front. The green ones are really ones that you probably saw in the science report. So there's some overlap here. But our tasks were slightly different, but there is some overlap. And the first one really being, we really need to have a statewide comprehensive monitoring evaluation program. We do have some up in the Upper Columbia, and you generally have three components, which is the hatchery environment, monitoring how those fish do in the hatchery environment. Making sure that we're hitting our in-hatchery survival targets is key. And then there's a whole new component about for conservation programs and to a lesser extent harvest programs. There's this natural environment monitoring, which when you start looking for conservation programs, you really start looking at life history traits, spawn timing, spawning location, and spawner abundance. And then the third component of these plans, at least in the ones that we use, is this analytical framework. And that really details the hypothesis testing, the monitoring objectives, and it lists all the targets and goals that you have for each of your objectives. Now, like I said before, where these programs do exist, they're kind of be regional, like up here in Region 2, or they're species specific, or there's even some program specific, like down in the Lower Columbia. And in addition, these uncertainties associated with hatchery impacts also confound habitat's effectiveness monitoring program. So these same kind of questions are being asked by our habitat folks who are trying to understand how habitat restoration is benefiting natural populations. There's a lot of common analogies here. Number two would be establish program-specific goals. This is how we measure success. So we're going to start having a conversation about our harvest programs so we can really try to understand what kind of fisheries these harvest programs contribute. The third one would be assess current population viability. And again, this is a similar one to the science report. For conservation programs and for our listed populations, there's these recovery phases that we're into. And each of these recovery phases has triggers that you move from one phase to the next. And the phase of the recovery is important because HSRG is kind of assigned a PNI associated or a PHAS associated with each of those recovery phases. So having a transparent, consistent methodology on how we assign the initial recovery phase and then the triggers that we use to move from one recovery phase to the next is going to be very critical. Right now, it's not quite clear how some of these things were assigned. They were done at the local level. We're suggesting we should do this at statewide level. Wild salmonid management zones, we are at 15% of where we need to be. Monitoring the natural variability and abundance is really important for both future hatchery and habitat effectiveness. We have to have good ways of controlling for this crazy variability we're seeing out in the ocean. And that's really what we're talking about. The in-basin variability can usually be attributed through common metrics like flow and temperature. Excuse me. But the ocean conditions really drive a lot of the overall abundance trends, and having wild salmonid management zones as a way to manage local natural variability and abundance is going to be critical in the future. Number five, improving estimates of spawner abundance and PHAS. It's both overall spawner abundance and the proportion of spawners that are hatchery fish. Like we've been talking about, these are some of the most critical, important metrics that we use in this process. A multi-generational fall Chinook study, a relative reproductive success study. Like I said, 70% of all the fish we release are sub-yearling fall Chinook, and it's really lacking in the literature. It'd be a nice addition to really kind of understand the entire kind of spectrum of hatchery influence. If we wanted to take it the next step further, we might look at chum and pink salmon, which spend actually very little time compared to sub-yearling Chinook in the hatchery. But those programs are really quite small relative to the department, so we're just suggesting right now fall Chinook, sub-yearling fall Chinook programs are really a must. Robust study designs to evaluate hatchery and reform actions. Set those up a priori, not post hoc. So if we really wanted to test some specific hypotheses, let's set that up, do the analysis beforehand so that we can understand what we're going to be able to do and say in the future, and not try to do these kind of retrospective stuff. A lot of times you can do a retrospective analysis, but it usually doesn't quite hit the mark. There's usually some issues that just prevent you from answering the hypothesis that you really want. And finally, number eight, reevaluate coated water tag release goals. This should probably be done periodically due to a changing ocean condition. These coated water tag groups are powerful monitoring and research tools. We did the analysis very early, not very early, about 10 or 15 years ago for a lot of the Columbia River programs that I work with directly. And the variability in SAR was so great that we just now, because we're in the upper Columbia, all of our fish are 100% marked and tagged because chasing that value is just too hard and too difficult. There's so much variability in SARs that we decided with the PUDs that 100% tagging was the most appropriate. Those are quite small programs. We have some really large programs. Certainly 100% marking is tagging is not required. But at least do the due diligence and reevaluate those coated water tag groups so you know that you're getting a good statistical inference.
Hey, Andrew. Commissioner Anderson has a question.
Sure. Perfect timing. You're on mute, sir.
For wild salmonid management zones, and you said something to the effect that we're only 15% of where we want to be. Can you expand on that?
15% in terms of the guideline. The guideline is one wild salmonid management zone per species per MPG. And so we added up all of our MPGs for all of our species, and there's a total of 54. And so we have 8 wild salmonid management zones, and that's about 15% of 54.
So it's going off the metric, not necessarily the value.
That's using the guideline as the standard.
Yeah. What you just went through is the number 8, reevaluate coated water tag release goals. Is that process through the Pacific Salmon Commission, through the Pacific Salmon Treaty, is that how that's done?
I think it can be done through that. The Chinook Technical Committee probably can do that, but they only look at certain stocks. right? They have indicator stocks and stocks they use for their management.
Right.
We certainly have hatchery programs that are not part of that analysis. So this is something that can be done in-house, and just looking at existing data and kind of seeing where we're at. Seeing if we're falling short, are we meeting the mark? It really is also, one point I didn't make clear is, it really also is important on what kind of questions you want to ask. So if your population is just a, So if your population is not a primary population and you're not asking really specific hard questions, then maybe you can work with a lower group. But if it's a really important population and you want to know very precisely what the PHAS is, then maybe you should re-examine Cotabar tag rates and make sure that you're getting good recoveries. Or if a population has survival issues. Sometimes the survival rate can just be a function of a poor or a low Cotabar tag release group. It's just process error associated with recovering and reporting those tags. So there's a lot of flexibility in that, and there's several things that can influence the analysis, but re-examining those rates periodically given ocean conditions would probably be a wise choice, because you could see some effects just simply because of lack of Cotabar tag returns. And then so there's a greater uncertainty associated with that.
Andrew, this is Gary. I just wanted to add, so the department has started a process of forming a committee to go over Cotabar tag group sizes and study designs for different Cotabar tag groups. I think another key component of this is just, this goes back to the metric where we looked at the SARs, is just ensuring that we actually have Cotabar tag groups on all of our hatchery production programs. There have been some notable programs that have lacked Cotabar tag data over the years due to funding constraints. And so, you know, when you don't have that survival data, it really cripples your ability to assess the programs as we were asked to do for the sort of analysis. So A is just ensuring you have tag groups for all the programs, and I think B is ensuring, you know, they're at the correct sizes once you have them established.
Okay.
So at this point, we're going to open it up to questions. We have a few folks with their hands up in the queue. Our eye is towards providing staff with guidance tomorrow. So just to sort of put in mind that some specifics now, and also thinking about what we need tomorrow to have a robust conversation. So we'll go to Commissioner McIsaac and then Commissioner Graybill.
Yes, thanks, Amy. In the previous several slides, I got the feeling that we've got a lot of way to go to make, there's a lot of opportunity to make things better in terms of monitoring and evaluation and designing research studies. And that's also consistent with what we heard in the science report back in February about the need for more robust evaluations. Earlier in the presentation, under the slide of the HSRG recommendation on monitoring and evaluation, it got a 73% grade, which is the second highest, or yellow color, which is the second highest grade you could get. But it seems like that was kind of outweighted by 100% subgrade on whether or not any program had had a change or not. So what's the right thing for the commissioners to take away on this? Do you think a lot of room to move to make things better on monitoring and research, or are we 73% of the way there and there's not that, I mean, we can do a little bit more, but it's not a huge gap?
So I think in terms of the recommendation about monitoring and evaluation, the specific recommendation about monitoring and evaluation programs, I think we are at 44%. That the overall principle may have been at a higher rate, but the specific recommendation, which I can't remember, I can scroll back. Yeah, so the specific recommendation about this is the M&E programs is we're at 44%. Overall, that was 73. Sorry for the confusion. Most of our hatchery programs, 56%, don't have an M&E program associated with it. Nor did we look at each individual M&E program and look for consistency across that. So we're not saying that you can just take those that 44% and roll that up. There may be large differences between those M&E programs. We just couldn't go into that level of detail for this report.
So when we start thinking about language changes in the policy, what I think I'm hearing from you is there's a lot of room to put some more stuff in there to be more specific about M&E and research programs and study designs and evaluation kind of things. Is that the right thing to feel?
I think so. A statewide. So the first recommendation is a statewide program. Now, that program can be consistent with existing programs, right? So there's no reason, and I'm sure most of them would be, but the first recommendation is a statewide comprehensive hatchery monitoring evaluation program. If we had that, we would be having a different conversation.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Graybill.
Yes, thank you. Andy, back on slides 39, 40, and 41, it sort of implies that HSRG is successful. And slide 42, it kind of implies that the WIRs are ineffective. And, you know, there's great hope that WIRs can be a very important tool for controlling PFAS. So I just want to be clear on those.
So are you talking about, Commissioner Graybill, are you talking about these slides?
Yes, 39, 40, and 41.
Okay, so these slides are a theoretical example that I've produced to try to make a point. This slide is from an analysis that I did in 2010, and actually all the PUD programs are undergoing a similar analysis in 2020, so there'll be some information coming out in the next year. So this is theoretical, made up. This is real. But it's dated. It's from 2010.
Right. But it does imply that HSRG guidelines have proven to be effective in this real example. Is that right?
Not exactly. The way I would interpret this slide is in the after period, right? So yeah. In the right-hand side of this graph, what we found is no significant difference from the left-hand side of the graph. So at least in this case, at this point in time, the hatchery program has not had the intended effect that we were looking to see. What we would want to see in the Methow is a much higher abundance level than Valley Creek, because Valley Creek is an unsupplemented control stream, and Methow is the treatment stream that got hatchery supplementation.
All right, that helps a lot, Andy. Thank you.
Okay, I am sorry I went too fast.
No, not at all. It's my brain's the slow part.
And what was the second part of the question?
On slide 42, it mentions that can we draw a conclusion that the WIR was not effective or was only used 5% of the time?
Yeah, no, I think what Thomas would say is that installing a WIR, it takes time to figure out how to run a WIR. And then I think what they also found is that placement of the WIR is very critical. So I think what they were seeing, so they only met their population level goal 5% of the time, because in some systems they can only install a WIR in a certain location, and then you still had a bunch of hatchery fish spawning downstream of the WIR.
Oh.
So you can't remove them if they don't come to the WIR. So it was more an example of just the, you know, putting the weir in there and then saying it's good is one thing. Having the data support that the implementation of a weir met the goal is another. And it's a tricky, you know, it's really difficult. There's not a really perfect weir out there. And you also have to have a perfect weir design and a perfect location. So it's just one of those things that I think we need to take into consideration when we're implementing reform actions. You know, is there a realistic expectation what we can do? We can only do so much. And I think this is just a really kind of extreme example of that.
All right, thank you.
Commissioner Thorburn.
Thanks. I'm kind of following up on the thinking I think Commissioner McIsaac was presenting and the questioning of Commissioner Grable, and that's getting to effective and comprehensive M&E. Is part of the problem that we haven't established really clear objectives, and then metrics that are attainable. I mean, there's a certain amount of routine monitoring that goes on with programs. Can we build that in as the metrics without having to set up elaborate research studies that are the only thing that can provide the monitoring answers? If we're looking, it seems to me, at this huge hatchery statewide, we've got lots of hatcheries, we're looking at a statewide M&E program, if we have to do research studies to do all the monitoring, it's going to become impossible, something we can't fund. Is there existing data that can provide us a lot of the monitoring information to measure objectives, I guess?
The short answer is yes. Research experiments are really intended to answer a specific hypothesis that would help inform our understanding of, for example, relative reproductive success. The monitoring programs that I'm talking about really involve the normal work that the agency does on an annual basis. What it really involves is having the ability to structure those data in a way that we can then analyze them across space and time in a consistent manner. We spend some time developing a plan. So we've been thinking about this a lot. The programs that we have in the Upper Columbia cannot be implemented throughout the state of Washington because they're very expensive. So we then have to use that as a kind of a guiding starting place, but then you'd have to develop kind of a statistical design that allows you to make inferences based on maybe one population to a group of populations. So you don't have to do, so there's some things that we normally do everywhere all the time. We want to be able to leverage that information, but at the same time, in some important populations, take it up a notch so that we can then transfer that information that we learned from that one population to, let's say, neighboring populations, so that we don't have to expend, you know, tens of millions of dollars. But let's also be clear, we do need to up our game. We need to improve spawner escapement methodologies. We need to have a comprehensive program that we can look across the state and make, you know, comparisons. There's a lot of work that we can do. There's a lot of information that we can use. But there's still some information that, you know, we're going to have to collect. But I would argue these are all routine information that we would just have to maybe either institutionalize how we do it or do a retrospective analysis to get us up to speed. I am not saying that we have to do big I mean, that's just not practical, right? Big experiments everywhere. This is a monitoring evaluation program that I think the fundamental, excuse me, the fundamental basis already exists. But we are, through time, let's be clear, through time, we have lost a lot of our capacity to collect some of those data. And that's just the reality of the way things have progressed. But we have some pretty good
examples. Yeah, that really gets to my question. I'll just say I'm from public health. We collect lots of data and stuff it into drawers, so I get it.
Commissioner Graybill.
Yeah, real quickly, you mentioned earlier, and I wanted to be clear, that 70% of all hatchery releases on the Columbia River, of all releases on the Columbia River, 70% of those are fall Chinook. And am I correct in my thinking that those, the vast majority of those at least, come from Priest Rapids Dam in the Snake River?
Close. 70% of all fish released from DFW hatcheries.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That's good. That's important. Thank you.
Okay. I don't see additional questions. Do people have some additional questions? Commissioner Anderson?
Yes, and I'm not sure this particularly well organized thought, but the with regard to the monitoring and evaluation, and I realize we're talking the hatchery element right here, and we've been talking about the all ages. It just seems to me, and I think it's apparent, that the habitat piece is such an integral element here in terms of the success of the fish. And just so when we're talking about, you know, the monitoring program, I think we need to be careful, you know, not to lose sight that the implications or the cause and effect or the connectivity between the habitat and the hatcheries. And I getting way out there in terms of, you know, I can't be real more specific on this, but I think it's important that as we consider this, that we really are taking that into account.
I think you're right on.
Yep.
I would think you're right on. And that's something, that we're going to talk about in this next section a little bit, is that the integration of, you know, and so, you know, from my seat in the Upper Columbia, I've also been slowly getting introduced into the habitat restoration world. And they're dealing with the exact same kind of criticisms and issues that we're dealing with. You know, well, you want $1 million to put in a log jam, how do you know it works? And that's the same thing. And then so to take your comment, the next step, I think the integration of habitat restoration and hatchery supplementation needs to be done at an integrated fashion, so they complement each other, and that, you know, there's not this kind of perception that, you know, oh, the hatchery program's working just fine, it's the habitat fault, or vice versa. You know, a few years ago, I coined a phrase: hatchery fish need habitat too. And so the expectation that I think you'll see in the next few examples, that without this integration, a hatchery program will fail. Or maybe not fail, a hatchery program will not meet its goals. And maybe that's a great segue, if Amy can remind me how much time I have.
I'm going to look for a few additional questions, and then we're going to take a 15-minute break and then come back, Andrew.
Oh, super.
Yeah.
15 minutes, okay.
Yeah. So I don't see any more hands up. Chair Carpenter, do you want to call us for a break at this moment?
Amy, I think that would be an appropriate thing to do. But I think if we could do 10 minutes, maybe that would suffice, and then we could get on about our business.
Okay. Okay, so we will reconvene at 10:55, and let's go ahead and take a break and grab some coffee, and we'll come back together.
Okay. Do we log off or log on?
I think you could. You can just stay on. You can turn off your video, perhaps, and then just turn your video back on for McIsaac's question about Priest Rapids that was not heard, so I'll repeat it here, which is that the Priest Rapids unmarked 3 million unmarked fish is a policy issue that's being addressed through the U.S. v. Oregon process. And we can try to get more than that, but at this moment, that's what we have.
Yeah, that's most likely enough for now. It's probably a bit of a more complicated issue, I would expect.
Okay.
Yeah, and I would add, I got some additional information that I forgot to mention. The entire program is now being otoliths marked. So the fish are marked in their otoliths, which is not an external mark. It's an internal mark that can be decoded after the fact. So it provides us some information, but it also prevents kind of real-time fisheries management.
You're fading in and out, Andrew, so come close again. And can you just say very briefly what an otolith mark is for folks?
Yeah, so an otolith mark, it's used on other species like pink and chum, but it's a mark that's laid down in the hatchery on the ear bone of the fish that can be removed after the fish is dead. And you can then, our lab can then decode it and tell you specifically the release group it's from. Each otolith mark is unique. So it does have some advantages over no mark, but it still provides some issues because there's not an external mark visible.
Excellent. Thanks, Andrew. Chair Carpenter, should we continue, or do you want to say anything at this moment as we reconvene?
No, go ahead. I think you're doing fine. I think some more questions will probably arise.
Okay. Okay, so now we're going to move to the next section of the presentation. There was a desire to get into the details around some specific hatchery programs and some of the information that we have from those programs. So we're going to take a deep dive into a few places and to use them as examples for our conversation moving forward. Go ahead, Andrew.
Yes, thank you. And I think Commissioner Anderson, you know, this is a good segue into this approach. So getting back to the guidance memo, where has the first policy guideline been strictly applied and what happened? And then where has it not been applied and what happened? So what we put together for you is four case studies of Chinook from the Columbia River, three of which are quantitative analyses using the Bakke approach, and one of them is a more qualitative approach with a lot of research behind it. And as we were talking, I made this graphic to kind of briefly describe this kind of all-H approach and how it really works, or maybe how it's intended to work or how it might be able to work. I'm not quite sure. But what you have is, you know, in a lot of our work, we use this kind of, on the outside, you'll see the salmon life cycle that starts with survival and it moves to juveniles and smolts. And at each box contains a survival rate and how each of these different H's interact during the salmon life cycle. So we just move along through the salmon life cycle. We go out to the estuary as adults and come back as spawners. And conceptually, when we think about the four H's, hatcheries really, so we interject here, we add a bunch of smolts to the system, which does cause some density-dependent issues, but it really comes in during the freshwater life stage at a smolt stage. And if applicable, those fish then go through the hydro system, which affects smolt survival, which ultimately affects carrying capacity in the ocean. And then they spend a few years out in the ocean, 1 to 3 years. They come back and harvest occurs on some stocks out in the ocean. And when these fish come back, if they have to go through dams, dams has a small effect, well, sometimes greater, depending on what dam we're talking about, on migration survival. And then we also see some harvest impacts from freshwater adults. And then hatcheries then pull out a few fish for broodstock, and we kind of just go round and round. So the whole point of this slide was to show you that the other H's affects some of these life stages, but critical to all these life stages is, like Commissioner Anderson was saying, was habitat. And how we can influence habitat and how we influence it at what critical life stage, right? We really want to be able to influence the limiting life stage for this population. And I think what we'll see as we go through some of these examples, when that limiting life stage is addressed through actions, then we see a positive response. When that limiting life stage is not addressed, and like in the previous example that I showed for the methow, it still exists. From a hatchery perspective, all we're doing is putting the hatchery fish through the same survival bottleneck that natural fish are experiencing. And generally what we find is a no effect from the hatchery program. Surprise, surprise. So this all H approach, the other H's can really have effects on specific life stages, but it's really this habitat component that needs to be better integrated into kind of our recovery planning. So the case studies we're going to talk about, here's this nice little table, is Snake River Falls Chinook, Chihuahua Spring Chinook, Tucannon Spring Chinook, and Yakima Spring Chinook. And this chart is supposed to kind of give you a kind of high-level comparison of how these populations are integrated. And this is a subjective category. And I think it'll be clear to you how I came up with these. The average PHAS rates for the program, so Snake River Falls Chinook has the highest PHAS, where the Spring Chinook programs generally fall around 0.5. The proportion of natural origin broodstock is also very low for Snake River Spring Chinook, but it's very high for Yakima Spring Chinook. And the Chihuahua and Tucannon populations, which are listed, fall somewhere in between. And at the end is the PNI, which is just the average PNI of these two values. We see it low for Snake River Falls Chinook, high for Yakima Springers, and Tucannon and Spring Chinook are kind of in the middle. Now, the all H designations really is to what degree, what I use is to what degree have the other H's played a role in the current status of this population, either intentional or unintentional. And so, and at the end, you can see that we have three, if we can get through all these, we have three that we've done a Bakke analysis on. However, the Snake River Falls Chinook is more of a qualitative analysis of that stock. So I had twice as many slides, so we can really dive deep in the details. But I was forced to cut them back.
Hey, Andrew, before you move off that slide, can you just remind the commissioners that low PNI, what generally it means, and high PNI generally what it means?
Yeah, low PNI means that the population is more influenced by the hatchery program, and high PNI means the population is more driven through natural origin influence. And generally what we're trying to do for conservation program is hit this magical 0.67, 0.66 mark. And for the Spring Chinook programs, we've come there close. And you do that through a combination of PNOB and PHAS like we talked about earlier. So for each of these programs, you're going to have to get a little bit of background, and I'll try to make it painful. But the first thing we're talking about, where has the guidelines been applied most stringently, and what has happened?
strangely, where they have been most applied, strangely applied in Washington State is not in a DFW-operated program, but in a Yakima Nation program in which DFW is a cooperator. And this is the Upper Yakima Spring Chinook Clay Elm Supplementation Research Facility. It's a very a relatively new program that has undergone a lot of research. It has a few acclimation ponds on the Yakima. One of the key things about this population is almost all the fish just spawn in the main stem Yakima itself. Whereas in the Wenatchee, most of our fish spawn in tributaries, and like in the Methow. But in the Yakima, it's mostly from, Easton Dam down to Clay Elm is most of the spawning. So it's all main stem spawners. Now, one of the very unique things that needs to be understood about the Yakima is that it is a completely artificially managed hydrograph. And over the years, the management of the hydrograph has been tweaked to benefit fish production. And so, I pulled up the 2015 drought year and compared it to the Upper Wenatchee, which is a natural hydrograph, compared to a managed hydrograph. And these three arrows indicate really important life stages for spring Chinook. And the first one being, you can see in the Wenatchee, you get this big spike during smolt-out migration. Because of the management in the Upper Yakima, a lot of that water is retained. They do have a small spike early, but once they start filling reservoirs, that spike goes away. So this is red because the lack of a spring freshet to move smolts through the tributary most likely has a negative impact on their survival. Conversely, as we go through the life stage and we get into this summer rearing period, so the summer rearing period often thought to be a limiting factor for a lot of spring Chinook populations. But you can see in the Yakima, flows in the Yakima are extremely high and stable throughout the summer rearing period, whereas at least in this drought year, and in other typical years, maybe not to this extent, the flow in the Wenatchee drops precipitously and also temperature increases as well. So as in the Upper Yakima, as spring Chinook emerge and rear throughout the summer and into the fall, they experience a lot of good, cold, clean water and full habitat. If you've been fishing in the summer down there, it's bank to bank all year long. Now, as we approach, and so when spring Chinook adults return, they also experience really high bank to bank water with good cold water, and they have much higher pre-spawn survival than Wenatchee spring Chinook salmon. So, while it's artificial and kind of unintentional, this artificial hydrograph really does benefit both juvenile survival and adult survival. As we approach spawning, and the Yakima spawns a little later, the hydrograph decreases, and over time, the operators, in consultation with co-managers, have kind of taped. It used to happen all in one day, and then we had stranding, and reds were stranded, and fish were stranded. So now they do this slow drop, and so they once right before spawning, and then so during spawning, fish have this really nice, stable, elevated spawning condition. They maintain flows to maximize spawner effectiveness. Whereas in a natural system, you know, you're subject to whatever happens. Now, there is still some spikes on this graph, and these are typically attributed to the Tienawe River in the Yakima, which is a small, unmanaged natural stream. But the Tienawe River also inputs generally downstream from all the spawning. So the take-home message is the Yakima is a very unique example within the state of Washington. It is a completely managed hydrograph for irrigation, but it also has some really important benefits for fish survival. Now, the program started. So here's a graph that you'll see one of these graphs or each of these examples. We had relative, it's an unlisted population. We had relatively, you know, okay returns,
But the program started bringing adults back in 2000, and we've had some pretty good returns of both wild fish and hatchery fish. And these are dam counts at Rosa, okay? And on average, a five-year PHAS has been about 51%. Over the life of the program, it's been 54%. Now, like I say, this program, Yakima Nation is the lead entity. It falls under the Yakima Klickitat Fisheries Project. So the Yakima Nation is the lead entity and the hatchery operator. The department is also a collaborator on this project. We do some of the M&E associated with the project and the research. Most of the data I'm showing you now is courtesy of Bill Bosch with the Yakima Nation. He's their data manager and does a great job. One way to describe this is Washington's test of supplementation. So this is a BPA-funded project. It had a lot of years of modeling go behind it, and there's been a lot of research associated with this program. Over 31, last I checked, there's over 31 peer-reviewed articles that talk about the research, about hatchery practices, non-target taxa monitoring. I mean, there's a flood of information about this population. But it does represent kind of one of these best case scenarios where we have a population that wasn't in deep trouble. So a lot of times we'll start a conservation program after we observe a bottleneck. And the population is already at low abundance, and then we have to go in there and try to do some kind of intervention. This population was doing okay, and they wanted to make it better. So kind of like Johnson Creek, it's a well-designed program, sufficient for the capacity of the habitat, and they use all natural origin broodstock. The goals of the program are increase natural origin fish abundance and increase in-basin harvest opportunities. There's a CNS fishery that happens down in the lower Yakima that's really important. And as part of this program, the Natchez River, which is right next door to the upper Yakima, is their control population. And so that population has no hatchery spring chinook in it whatsoever. The program does strictly follow best management practices, according to the HSRG. We had years of planning and modeling, and it has a release goal of about 110,000 fish, so it's a relatively robust. For a spring chinook program, it's pretty big, and it has three acclimation sites, two on the main stem and one on a tributary. And like I said, 100% natural origin broodstock. They also have what's called a hatchery line. So because this is a research facility, they actually have some returning hatchery fish are not allowed to spawn naturally. And for research purposes, they just recycle those fish through the hatchery to try to evaluate the effects of domestication. But like I say, there's 31 papers on this thing. And we're also working with the Yakimas on a multi-generational reproductive success study. So the lead researcher down there, Dr. Dave Fast, and all these other folks published a paper a few years ago looking at the effectiveness of the program in relation to their program goals. And they looked at red abundance, which is a surrogate for spawner abundance, natural ore abundance, and in-basin harvest rates. So these are the three metrics they evaluated using the Bakke design to find out whether or not their program is meeting their goals. And so what they found was they did find a significant increase in abundance relative to the Natchez River. So if you look down here, as a result of this hatchery program, during the after period time, they had a 126% increase in the Yakima compared to a 52% increase in the Natchez. So that was statistically different, a good positive result. When they tried to look at nor abundance, although there was a 9% increase in the Yakima and at the same time a 9% decrease in the Natchez, it was not statistically significant. But they did not incorporate the next metric, which is harvest. And what you'll see is there's a lot of these fish that were harvested before they got to the spawning grounds. But needless to say, while not significant, we did see an increase in natural origin fish abundance relative to the control population. And they also found a significant increase in harvest. So harvest was not included in the prior analysis because a lot of this harvest happens as a mixed fishery downstream of the mouth of the Natchez. So I don't think there was ability to separate natural origin fish harvested by the tribe into a Yakima or Natchez group. So it was not included in the previous analysis. But what we can see is that in the pre-treatment period or the before period, the tribe was harvesting about 435 natural origin fish, and there was no sport harvest. In the post period, the tribe's been harboring a combination of natural and hatchery origin fish of about 1,223 per year, and we now have a sport fishery with an average harvest about 529. So they did meet this goal about increasing harvest rates.
So Andrew, let's pause here just for a minute because I think after this you go to the Snake River.
Yeah.
And let's see if there's any questions about this example and how this example informs our overall understanding of hatchery reform. Just pause for a second. Commissioner McIsaac?
Yeah, thank you. I'm just going to ask the same question you just did, Amy. So the message is exactly what? So we had a population that was not listed, and for supplementation reasons, apparently there was still underseeding going on or something. But anyway, here comes a hatchery program. Did it work? Did it not work? Or do we not really know for sure?
So this program, as intended, this program did work. I think this is a 100% natural origin brood stock, very similar to the Johnson Creek program up in Idaho that has been subject of a lot of discussion, right? They started this program before the population got to a point of listing, so they had an adequate number of spawners to collect brood stock from. I think one of the points that I'm trying to make, and so this is a published study, so it's the example that I can think of, at least in Washington for Spring Chinook. But one of the points that I guess I was trying to make, it is very unique in that managed hydrograph doesn't really exist. Well, it kind of does exist when we talk about Snake River Falls Chinook in the same kind of scenario. That managed hydrograph, I'm suggesting that managed hydrograph has eliminated some of the life stage limiting factors within that basin. So it allowed the addition of those hatchery fish to be productive and experience similar survival rates than before the hatchery program started. In a typical non-regulated system, like you'll see in the Chihuahua and Tucannon, that's not the case. So this is a very unique example. But it is an example in the literature of a successful program using HSRG recommendations. In fact, Dr. Fast was a member of the HSRG early on, and he's just recently retired. Congratulations, if he's on the phone.
So as a follow-up to that, the PHAS values seem to be pretty high, over 50%, which I would have thought in our policy, which as currently written, if there was no suspension, would be following the HSRG guidelines, which would have said that's too high. But you're saying 58% proportion of hatchery fish is fine as long as you take care of your hatchery brood stock the way occurred here?
In this example, using 100% hatchery or 100% natural origin brood, those PHAS rates have still produced a significant increase in abundance. Now, this is also the other caveat that we'll talk about at the end. This is also a relatively recent program, okay? And that's one of the questions.
Question, teacher.
Oops. And that is one of the other questions is long-term effects. So this program started, fish started showing up on the spawning grounds really in earnest in 2000. But some of these other examples, we've had fish two generations longer. So there is still kind of a question about what's going to happen in 20 years, right? When we reanalyze this population again, are we still going to see the same effects? Or are there some long-term genetic things going on that just aren't showing after a couple generations? So I think it's good news early on, but I would pause and try to re-answer that question maybe in 10 years.
But for this period of time, if this was a state hatchery and not a tribal hatchery, would 58% PHAS been in compliance with the 2009 policy or out of compliance with it?
Well, I think if we look at the P&I, the P&I is almost at that 0.67, which is, it's 0.66 with some noise, right? So the P&I of the program is really a natural, so natural fish are driving this population when we get P&I over 0.5 versus P&I below 0.5, it's the hatchery fish driving the population. So I think maybe that would be the take-home message, is that this is really a high P&I, one of the highest that we can find.
Okay. Commissioner Thorburn? Hold on. There we go. Commissioner Thorburn? You are unmuted. Oops. Hold on. Okay, go ahead.
So can you hear me?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I think, Andrew, that you alluded to this in the first part of your response to Commissioner McIsaac, but since there is this basically habitat issue of the managed waterway that it provides for the optimal spawning period, how do we separate out habitat effects from the hatchery effects in the benefits of this, the positive responses of this population?
Yeah, that is a good question. So, and that's an ongoing issue with a lot of the work that we do, and we refer to it as multiple treatment effects. So the habitat effect in the Yakima existed before the hatchery program was there. So one can conclude that the treatment effect is still just the habitat effect, or excuse me, is still just the hatchery program. I think the point that I'm suggesting, and again, I'm suggesting this, is that the conditions that are unique in the upper Yakima, they don't, because of those conditions, they don't experience life stage limiting factors like non-regulated systems do, right? So when we don't have summer rearing par or adult pre-spawn survival being limiting factors, like we, to a lesser extent, is probably occurring in the Yakima, when we add additional hatchery fish, those fish benefit similarly from as the natural fish. I guess maybe that's what I'm, maybe I haven't made that point very clear. That here's a case where we may not have as many limiting factors. Now, because they don't have a big spring freshet, that could be one of their limiting factors that prevents additional natural fish from being realized. But clearly, I think the benefit of those of that regulated system, with some fine-tuning by co-managers, by the way, it wasn't always like that, has been able to produce these results.
Okay, Andrew, we're going to move to the next example, but you only have 6 minutes for the next example. We're a little
okay.
bit over.
Yep. Okay, so Snake River Fall Chinook, very unique, one population in this ESU. The Snake River is used, like it said, for all life stages. There is a little bit of spawning happening in some tributaries, but, I mean, most of these fish spawn in the main stem Snake River.
And so this all-age approach, it's kind of been implemented ad hoc for decades. But the effectiveness of these all-age actions have not been quantified in any terms of their contributions to adult natural fish abundance. All right. So these are action agencies making tweaks to the hydro system in order to increase survival rates, but they have not specifically, that I'm aware of, tried to relate actions directly to a fish population response. And so this is a qualitative assessment of this population because, let's be real, there has been a big change in this population since the hatchery program has started. It is important to note that accurate estimates of hatchery fish abundance are very recent in terms of the 2007 brood year for the same reason that we talked about mass marking earlier. This was one program that had some marking, but as the program expanded, as you'll see, there was a lot of fish that were not marked. And it was a recent change just a few years ago that they started using PBT, which is parental-based tagging. So they would take genetics on all the hatchery brood stock, and when adults came back, they would then do a parental analysis and assign fish back to a hatchery brood stock. So if fish were assigned to parents from the hatchery brood stock, then they were considered hatchery fish. If they weren't, they were considered wild fish or natural origin fish. But that's a recent thing. This program's been going on for decades. So before that, estimates of PHAS, well, they were derived, let's just say, through other methods that probably have changed through time. And I'm not really privy to those specific methods. But needless to say, they were not as accurate or precise as the current methods. And a lot of these data were provided by, we have a group on the called the Snake River Lab that does a lot of the evaluation on the Lions Ferry component of the program. And overall, the programs run through the Lower Snake River Compensation. So here's my graphic that I made to look at the other three H's. And in the middle, these bars represent the hydro. And so early on, 1975 was when Lower Granite Dam was complete. And these green parts up here, these are kind of habitat actions. And these are kind of harvest actions. So here's the other three H's I'm trying to describe. And the first habitat action is once Lower Granite Dam was done, it created the pool and it changed a lot of habitat. But early on in the Snake River and in the Lower Columbia, they started to experiment with these juvenile fish bypasses, which are a structural change to the dam to try to bypass fish around the turbines. And these devices were being installed on Lower Snake and Lower Columbia dams all the way up to about 2010, where you have this solid green line. And that's the period in time in which all Snake River and Lower Columbia dams had operational juvenile bypasses, right? So they were getting the full benefit of this juvenile bypass. At the same time, they were trying to do increased smolt survival by barging fish around the dams. Right, and so there's been a lot of discussion and questions about are these really good or bad? They still weren't helping enough. So then they started in 2005 a summer spill program specifically targeted at Snake River Fall Chinook. And so some research done by Bill Connor et al. Actually showed that the summer spill program releasing more cold water would increase smolt survival. So there's been a lot of work done in the hydro system. Meantime, we're not installing log jams in the Snake River, but there's also been some kind of indirect hatchery effects through reducing predation from northern pike minnow and avian predation, and through habitat releases of cold water from dwarf shack, and then reducing power peaking and stable flows through Hell's Canyon Dam to improve not only pre-spawn migration success and pre-spawn survival, but also to prevent stranding of reds. So these actions really kind of, quote-unquote, affected positively the habitat within the Snake River, not in the traditional way. At the same time, we saw reductions in harvest due to listing in 1992,
And then through a sequence of other actions, we've seen more protection for natural origin Snake River Falls Chinook through the Pacific Salmon Treaty, the Steelhead, and Mark Selective Fisheries. So the point of this slide was that we got a lot of H's going on here in addition to a hatchery program. I tried to look up a number, and it's between $3 and $17 billion is represented on this graph. Here's a slide that you're familiar with, I think. We started with an egg bank program, and then we slowly moved, really, really struggled, and we started seeing this dramatic increase. Right now, we're still running 72% PHAS over the 39 years of the program at 68%. So still a very hatchery-driven system. But we still got some wild fish, for sure, and some good numbers of wild fish. The hatchery program, like I said, started as this egg bank program. It is probably responsible, for preserving this stock. But once that program then transitioned into this Lyons Ferry stock. And then as that program progressed, we started adding these different hatchery programs that brought fish up into the natural spawning areas. Instead of, so lower, Lyons Ferry Dam is on the lower river. There is not any spawning of false chinook down there. It all occurs above lower Granite Dam. But the whole point is there's been a lot of hatchery production sequenced throughout this time period. And as a result, we've seen a big shift in release location of fish. This is kind of this is below Lower Granite, which means Lyons Ferry releases. And now you can see in the last many years, most of these fish, the far vast majority of these fish are released above Lower Granite at acclimation facilities throughout the main stem Snake River and some of the tributaries. So take home, egg bank program was great. The program was adaptively managed by the co-managers, the lower snake comp, to move fish into natural production areas. We've been steadily increasing PNOB, but still PNOB is still really low. It's a huge program, but PNOB is still really low. Recent estimates are 0.3, and PHAS is still pretty high. I think probably all these different H actions had a major role in the current status. It's now considered viable, but because there's one population in this ESU, it needs to be at a highly viable status, and they're still kind of trying to get to this magic PNI of 0.67.
Okay, we're going to pause there because we're at the time where we want to take some more questions and then have public comments. So let's do the commissioners have any questions at this moment? Okay, I'm not seeing any. Andrew, thank you so much. One of the things I really appreciate about your presentation is that it both is able to speak across these different disciplines of habitat and hydro and the various H's and give us some really excellent analysis just on the hatchery side. So thank you for all of that and for the work. So let's, I'm going to turn it over to
Ted. Amy, can I just make one final comment? So sorry I took so long. The other two presentations that I was going to go through were analysis that we conducted on two of our programs. And for the Chihuahua and Toucanon programs, when we conducted the Backe analysis, we found no significant increase. And in part, because really the at least it is my opinion, that the all-H integration was far of less magnitude and effect than these previous two studies. In the Chihuahua program, there is essentially no work planned for the Chihuahua River. It's deemed pristine. So in that case, there is some limiting factor. In both of those cases, I would argue, there is still some life stage limiting factor that is preventing the hatchery benefit from being realized. But in these two cases, I think we saw they're very unique. And there's some common things about, controlling flow and making artificial habitat. But in the other two cases where they're natural hydrographs, we are just not seeing that. And that's that is the same result that they found in the Idaho supplementation studies, is that when you don't integrate habitat with hatcheries, you're pretty much going to get a status quo situation. And with that, I thank you very much for your time.
All right. Thank you, Andrew. Okay, I'm going to ask for Melissa and Tess to help us through this next section.
Sure. So we now have time for public comment. And this means that if you've joined the meeting by phone, if you want to raise your hand for public comment, you're going to go ahead and press *9 on your phone, and that will raise your hand. If you've joined via your computer, there's a black dash bar down at the bottom where you should see a raise the hand feature. So if you have something you want to say, click on that icon, and then as soon as we see hands going up, we will move through them one at a time. And it looks like our first person with their hand up is Alan Chapman.
Okay. My experience is mostly in the Puget Sound area, and the examples discussed here seem to relate mostly to the complicated Columbia system. My understanding of the HSRG was that it was to set specific measurable goals for the hatchery activities, which can include harvest, supplementation, or recovery. In Puget Sound, much of the habitat has been lost through legacy activities, and one questions the value of trying to recover, I guess. And I guess the question is, when do you just focus on the what I understand the basic point of the HSRG is just make sure that if you say you're going to do something, do it. And that implies that you have agreed goals. And I wonder how well some of the goals are agreed amongst all of the constituencies. So I guess the question is, it seems like there's an overemphasis on these PNI, PNOB, PHAS, and all that stuff, rather than the results that come out. And I guess I have a stronger interest in the harvest aspect, and that means a sustainable harvest where your hatchery activities are producing harvests that warrant the expense of the hatcheries.
Great. Thank you for that, Alan. I don't know if either of our DFW staff wants to make any additional comments there. Otherwise, I will go ahead and look for additional hands that are raised. I'm not seeing anyone else.
Yeah, I can take a shot at it. I think it's a really good point. I mean, one of the things that happened early on in this process was that, I mean, you're right. This report really focused on the implementation of the policy guidelines with respect to HSRG recommendations and guidelines. The point the caller made was a good one in that a lot of the goals, and as we pointed out, we don't have harvest goals for each specific program. And that's something that we're going to start considering. And the goals of conservation programs, again, they are right now by de facto the recovery goals. So there is additional need in some programs to have a healthy and harvestable, sustainable run. And so those discussions are also happening. Unfortunately, those discussions haven't concluded with co-agreement by co-managers. So right now we're talking about kind of some of the more technical nuts and bolts of implementing some of these things. I hope that's satisfactory.
Thanks, Andrew. Looks like we've got another hand raise from somebody who has called in, and Their phone number is ending in 4523. So I'm going to go ahead and get you unmuted here.
Good morning, Chair Carpenter, Commission, staff, Greg King here. Just wanted to state that we have to remember that HSRG is a tool, not a rule. I disagree with Mr. Murdoch on HSRG isn't affecting our fisheries. We're looking at going through this north of Falcon. We're getting shut down in Puget Sound. We just got some more updates from Columbia River Fisheries. It's going to be terrible this year. We produce 160 million less fish in Washington State. It's a lot of great science. I see a lot of unanswered questions here. We asked to review the Clackamas study that showed that summer run steelhead had no effect on late wild winters, and it's been ignored. Sports are frustrated with this whole fishery. And I also forgot to say, I hope everybody's safe and healthy with this pandemic we're having. But getting on to this thing, we show that any successful programs that we've seen are hatchery supplementation. And we also know that some of the top scientists have said that hatcheries are the tool to recovery of wild fish. And I believe that coming down from the legislatures, that we didn't have to use HSRG, we didn't have to use third-party science. We have some of the best scientists in the world with NOAA Fisheries, the tribes, and the department. Let's use these people to guide us and use the Hatchery Genetic Management Plan to guide us. I know we don't have one on Willapaw. Willapaw's a disaster. We could do so much on Willapaw, and I just hope the commission will, you know, our fisheries are on life support, and to keep pouring money into this ongoing reviews of this, instead of getting some solid answers to our questions, and let's use the NOAA and the tribes and the department and bring them all together to use the best available science and use some of these guidelines. Like I said, it's a tool, not a rule. And start, we need to produce some fish, Larry. You know that. You made the statement that we're going to lose our fisheries in 10 years, and I'm going to keep reminding you, Larry, that the clock is ticking. So those are my comments. Thank you.
Thanks, Greg. All right. For folks who are on the line, who dialed in on their phone, if you do have something you want to say, go ahead and raise your hand by pressing *9 on the phone, and we can get you unmuted. For folks who are joining by the computer, look for that raise the hand icon at the bottom of your screen. All right, I am not seeing any more hands from our attendees at this point. So I'm going to just hand it back over to Larry, if you've got any other words.
Well, no, I tell you, that's a lot to absorb. I appreciate the folks that called in. Mr. Chapman, I've known for a long, long time, a very well-respected manager. And Greg King, thank you for your comments. Anybody else I missed? I think what this did for me is it raised a lot of questions that I had in the back of my mind, and now they're much closer to the front. So I'm going to be working on Some additional questions and thoughts that I can share with some or all of you going forward. Mr. Murdoch and your colleagues and other folks from staff really, really appreciate your knowledge base and the fact that you're willing to put yourself through this. We're trying to get to a point where we can come forward with something that's workable, going to improve the fish runs and improve, and certainly improve fishing opportunities into the future, because they are, as one of the callers mentioned, are not in very good shape currently. So I see that Commissioner McIsaac has his hand way in the air. So I'll just I'll stand by and listen in. And I want to thank everyone for their participation, and thanks to all the commission members.
Well, thank you, Larry. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes, we can, Don.
Okay. Well, let me just follow up on the chairman's remarks about thanking the staff for this effort here. About a month ago, the report was released, I guess, before our Kennewick meeting. We were going to talk about it first over there. And when I read the report, I was a little disappointed that the qualitative assessment was not mentioned in the assignment section, or I couldn't find very much of it in the report. And but now I'm very happy to see in this slide presentation a lot of excellent thinking that gets to some of these fundamental questions that Amy's been talking about that we're going to have to wrestle with. So there's sure been a lot of work on this, very obviously. A lot of analysis on implementation matters. That's a difficult thing to try to get quantitatively, but I think we have a good feel about the spread of implementation things that have happened over the course of the past 10 years. And I'm very happy to see a little venturing into the area of whether or not the policy has performed as hoped 10 years ago, or maybe not performed as hoped 10 years ago, or we simply can't tell. And there's also some very good thinking here in terms of to try to make that better. I know Commissioner Thorburn talked about something that's enabled a not real expensive but informative ongoing monitoring. I'd like to hear more about the thinking on a little bit more about that. But all in all, that first draft was one where if you can... We saw here today, and that as you move that towards some stage of finality, I think that will be a very useful tool as we move through the rest of the process. So just kind of echoing the thanks to that was offered here by the chairman, and appreciate it very much.
Chair Carpenter, this is Commissioner Thorburn. If I could just make a comment. I really appreciated we've had quite a few attendees sitting all the way through this, and a couple who've made really good comments. The instruction for those who are on the video is to look at the band at the bottom of your screen for the hand raise. And that isn't how it works for me. I actually have to go into the participants, hit that icon, and then open that, and the hand raise is at the bottom of that. So I'm just hoping that perhaps, or wondering if maybe some of the attendees on video haven't found the hand raise and haven't had an opportunity. So I just wanted to explain that. And wait for just a little bit longer to see if there are any other attendees who have a comment.
Commissioner Thorburn, that's a great comment. Actually, my screen works, I believe, as does yours, where the hand raise and mute is at the bottom of the right side of the screen. But that's a great point. Anybody else have any other commissioners' thoughts, comments, as it relates to what Commissioner Thorburn stated?
And just to note that the attendee view and panelist view are definitely different. If folks are having trouble finding the raise the hand feature, you can plug something into the question and answer, and we can help troubleshoot there. But attendees kind of come in just as more of a listen-in type place, and so they actually can't see everybody else in quite the same way that the panelists can. So I know this is new for everybody, so we are here to learn together, and I do think it's important to do a pregnant pause just to make sure we aren't missing any last thoughts. Again, that's *9 for those callers that came in on the phone.
And I'm also seeing that we do have a Q&A that came in, written. Shall I go ahead and read it?
Yeah, I see that as well. Go ahead.
When are we going to realize that recovery of natural stocks to the point that they will be successful and ensure gold that will support fisheries in a cost-effective manner, and that will focus natural habitat actions on protection of or improvement of natural ecological processes to meet cultural social needs in the face of the development activities that tend to destroy the natural ecological processes? Wish we had a crystal ball on that one, I guess.
I think it very much could be part of our deliberations going forward on how we're going to encompass that question into future policy guidance, I believe. Anybody else have any comments on that? Anyone have anything else to add before we stand down for the day? Hearing and seeing none, I guess I'll move to adjourn this this meeting. And thank you very much to everyone involved. A lot of thoughts generated, a lot of things to figure out, a lot of work to do. So thank you all. Fish Committee at 1 p.m. today. Thank you, and I will be leaving.